This is Bloomberg Best.
Bloomberg Best is about the insight and the context that we get from our guests.
It's a great way to catch up on some of the stories you might have missed on the Bloomberg.
Stories you're not going to find in any other news organization.
Bloomberg Best. Bloomberg's best stories of the day, powered by 2,600 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries around the world.
I'm June Grosso.
And I'm Ed Baxter on this edition of Bloomberg Best for Wednesday, March 22nd.
Nobel Prize-winning economist Robert Shiller talks about the recent boost in the stock market and what it could mean for the economy.
It's high, but that doesn't tell you what it's going to do in the next few days. It just says that maybe sometime in coming years it will have a correction down.
And the CEO of S&P Global, Doug Peterson, talks the importance of infrastructure spending.
Infrastructure done in the right way for the right reasons really creates jobs and growth.
All this and more coming up in the next hour of Bloomberg Best.
Investors are fearing the end of the Trump trade after this week's stock market sell-off, which saw the S&P 500 fall the most since Donald Trump's election. Jonathan Golub, chief U.S. market strategist at RBC Capital Markets, and Nobel Prize-winning economist Robert Shiller talked about the markets with Bloomberg's Jonathan Farrow and Alex Steele. They began with Professor Shiller.
We're still high, though. I emphasize this CAPE ratio, cyclically adjusted price-earnings ratio. It was down to 13. That's a sort of price-earnings ratio. It was 13 in the bottom of the market in 2009, and now it's almost 30. So it's high. But that doesn't tell you what it's going to do in the next few days. It just says that maybe sometime in coming years it will have a correction down. It's not a great time to be investing in the stock market.
I want to bring in Jonathan Golub of RBC, Professor. Jonathan, you listened to the professor's remarks. What do you have to say back to that, that we're incredibly high and it's not a great time to buy into the equity market?
Well, and I think that Dr. Shiller raises the most important point. This is not a good intermediate term indicator of where the stock market is going. Now, what investors tend to focus on, whether it be guys at hedge funds or mutual fund companies, is forward stock multiples. And 17.5, just like Dr. Shiller's CAPE number, is high compared to history, but it's gone to substantially higher levels. And to me right now, you're not seeing the indications such as recessionary risk that would tell you that there's risk in the very near term that this thing is going to roll over. So expensive, yes. Likely to be more expensive before it's over, also yes.
Well, and fair point, Professor. If you take a look at where it's been and you compared the optimism in the market today versus where we were back in 2000, but the CAPE ratio there was near 45 at the end of the day, a very different story.
Yeah, I haven't, I agree. I haven't really sold my stocks. The competing real estate and fixed incomes aren't so great either. So I think that, but it's also correct that expectations are high under Trump. According to my own surveys, I find evidence of that. Confidence in the valuation of the market is low. But that still sounds like the 1990s. You know, it still could go way up. I agree.
Yeah, the one big difference, Alex, between now and I think the late 90s was the companies that were expensive then were companies that we had massive hope in, the AOLs or the tech companies with no earnings and a promise of something in the future. If you look at today's growth companies, the Googles and the Facebooks and the Amazons, these are companies with solid earnings and cash flows that are, you know, I wouldn't even say mature companies, but are maturing companies that are very different. And the companies that are actually being bid up in many cases are the really stable companies in consumer staples and in some of these bond proxies that the market is putting a higher valuation. So while there's optimism in today's market, and I think that there should be, it doesn't really feel, there's a different tone today than it was in the 90s.
Well, Professor, I actually hear that comparison made beyond equity markets and in credit as well. Leverage has been building up in credit no matter what grade you look at. But the pushback I get is that they're higher quality companies. They have better cash flow, et cetera, et cetera. What do you say back to that, Professor, that actually the valuations are steep compared to the 90s? Yes, they're still there. But actually the quality of the companies are better?
Yes, I think back in the 1990s, it was a gold rush mentality. And there was the new idea then was that companies shouldn't be focused on earnings. because it's a, you know, stake your claim time, a turning point for the whole world with the internet just coming in. And obviously the internet would be very important. So you just lost mooring, but now we're back into a more normal environment. Yeah, we're talking about big companies that were founded 20 some years ago. And we're not, no longer, I don't hear it so much that companies shouldn't worry about earnings. Now we expect earnings.
Yeah, except maybe in cases like Amazon, maybe you're going to forgive a little bit because of CapEx. But the idea, Professor, do you make the distinction between certain sectors that have a higher CAPE ratio than others?
Yes. Well, I work with Barclays Bank on this. And right now, we emphasize the best priced sectors are consumer durables, healthcare, industrials, and technology. Technology tends to have a high CAPE ratio, but we're correcting for that.
So, Jonathan, does that line up with what you would be investing in then?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. If you look at technology in particular, you have to look at the valuation relative to the growth rate, and they just seem extraordinarily attractive, even though, as Dr. Schill was saying, and I think we're in agreement here, expensive, but in this case, I think that they're really worth it given the opportunity.
That was Jonathan Golub, Chief U.S. Market Strategist at RBC Capital Markets, and Nobel Prize-winning economist Robert Shiller, talking with Bloomberg's Jonathan Farrow and Alex Steele.
Coming up, we talk banking in Europe with the Chief Executive Officer of the Bank of Cyprus.
You can see all the Bloomberg Best Stories at Best Go. This is Bloomberg. John Hourican is a chief executive officer at the Bank of Cyprus. He spoke earlier with Bloomberg's Jonathan Farrow and Alex Steele.
Messy politics and running a bank in a Eurozone. Talk to me about how difficult that is right now.
Look, I think the ECB is still finding its feet. You know, we have 18 banks being managed in a centralized manner. The average is the key word. And I think that's a struggle. You know, the national competent authorities were able to balance fiscal sort of stability and financial stability with microprudential regulation, and these have been separated, and that causes tension.
UBS out this morning extending charges on deposits of some of their biggest clients. How difficult is the negative rate story for you? We talk about it at negative 40 basis points, what it means for bond markets, but to actually run a bank with the deposit rate in negative 40 basis points, what does it mean?
Look, there's a high correlation between bank valuations and an interest rate curve, right? And the interest rate curve is negative, so the cost of money, you know, for the Eurozone is at an all-time low. But actually, I can't mind it for you for free unless I can make a margin. Now, I'm in a sub-investment grade economy, so I have some room in the margin. But if you're in the core of the Eurozone, you can't pass that on. So now you have to start charging.
Do you see an ECB that's gradually going to shift towards the view of the banks that if you really want us to finance the economy, you've got to do something with rates?
Yeah, look, I think the underlying problem is we're struggling to create growth in the Eurozone, and a very, very accommodating monetary policy is fine during the crisis, but what do you do afterwards? So, look, I think there's a lot of work to do to get this right.
All things considered, the last few days, take it aside, we had seen the bund curve steepen quite a bit. Not by the absolute level, of course, but it did outpace in terms of steepness what happened here in the U.S. Is that going to be the driver of markets? Is it not the Fed? Is it not the curve here? Is it going to be that bund curve over in Europe?
Look, I think it's going to be a significant bellwether for what happens next. You know, the banking sector in Europe is really struggling to create profitability. And if you can't create profitability, you can't create value. And if you can't create value, you know, there's no source of capital, so you create risk in the system. There's a lot of pressures on the banking system in Europe today.
You ran RBS, the investment bank, through pretty tough times, 08 through to 2013. You know that industry inside out at its depths. Looking at the situation now, people talking about the UK losing passporting rights in the negotiations with the European Union. How significant is that, and what's the likelihood of it actually happening, John?
Well, look, the starting point of that is that the UK has already handed much of its investment banking prowess to the United States. So the majority of global capital flow actions now happen outside of the UK. Some still happen in the UK, but not much of it. But the passporting issue is as much an issue for Europe as it is for the UK. I mean, there are as many and more companies in Europe with passporting into the UK as there are in the UK with passporting into Europe. I think we need a more mature conversation. If we're going to have trade liberalization continuing and we're going to have trade as the center of prosperity, I think they need to have a more grown-up conversation than some of the rhetoric in recent days.
Some of the rhetoric around the issues in Greece, around the issues in Cyprus, we've kind of seen this movie before and it doesn't necessarily follow the course of logic. Why will it this time?
Well, I'm not sure it will, but let's hope it will, because if you want 70 million people leave a trading block, that's a big deal for the residual trading block. And it's suggesting there's something wrong with how things are being worked. So what we need to do is actually get back, have a cold drink, and actually talk about how we're going to work together rather than how we're going to separate.
Well, when you look at the industry in London at the moment, how do you see it coming out the other side of 2 years of negotiations, potentially more?
Look, I think sense will prevail at some point, because it has to. Logic says that Britain and Europe have to work together. The City of London is a major place where capital requirement meets capital provision, and that will continue post a Brexit. What we have to do is make sure that actually Europe is advantaged from that continuing relationship rather than disadvantaging itself.
Are you confident that the UK has got the team in place to make the argument that you just laid out on financial services?
Look, I went through some interesting discussions with the UK Civil Service during our time at RBS.
Yeah.
And they are full of very smart people who've seen the movie in some shape or form before. I think when we get down to the real basics of how this works, we'll find a sensible solution, because it is mutually assured self-destruction is not the path we should follow.
Bank of Cyprus just listed in London. Yeah. You think any advantages, any benefits of doing that?
Look, it's a journey. So we've listed there. We're preparing now for premium at some point in the future. You know, we'd like to be index included at a point in the future. Every step we take is an important step in our journey to rehabilitation. Coming off the Athens Exchange was important for us, because Cyprus is certainly dislocated in terms of its performance than Greece, and we want to make sure that sticks in investors' minds. We're seeing better volumes. We're not yet seeing better price action, but I think it's up to us to deliver the story so that the price follows.
Was that a bank casting its vote in confidence as London as a financial centre, a global financial hub for years to come, regardless of what happens with Europe?
Unquestionably. London is a major financial centre, and we think it will exist post any discussions about Brexit, no matter how painful they may be.
I mean, through the negotiations, you've set out quite a logical argument as to why it's the benefit for both sides to come out of this with a deal around passporting. Your base case at this point, John, though, what is it?
Look, I think there's going to have to be a sensible retention of the majority of the issues around passporting for both sides, because otherwise you damage both sides. And that can't be right in a negotiation where it's a lose-lose.
That was John Hourican, Chief Executive Officer of the Bank of Cyprus, speaking with Bloomberg's Jonathan Farrow and Alex Steele.
Coming up, we talk more about the Brexit effect on Europe with former Italian Prime Minister Mario Monti.
You can see all the Bloomberg Best stories at Best Go. This is Bloomberg.
This is a Bloomberg Quick Take. Context and background on issues of interest.
Our focus is on South Korea's table. Is it time for those business giants to change? With Bloomberg's Peter Pei in Seoul.
The situation.
Well, they are sprawling conglomerates with, you know, dozens and sometimes up to 60, 70 affiliates. What's unique about them is they are family-controlled, almost a corporate dynasty, if you may.
The background.
The Jebels have come under the spotlight. You know, the Jebels have been operating in this cozy business-government relations for a while, but the sense now is that the public, that tolerance is no longer there.
The argument.
There's a feeling that because of their undue influence, oversized influence, that they're stifling innovation, stifling small businesses. So there's a major backlash against this whole system.
For more on South Korea's Chaebol or other quick takes, go to BloombergView.com/quicktake, or for terminal customers, go to NIQuick. I'm Charlie Pellett, Bloomberg Radio.
You're listening to Bloomberg Best on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm June Grosso.
And I'm Ed Baxter. Bloomberg Best is brought to you by Sector Spider ETFs. Why buy a single stock when you can invest in the entire sector? Visit SectorSPDRS.com or call 1-866-SECTOR-ETF.
Mario Monti is the former Prime Minister of Italy. He also served as a European Commissioner from 1995 to 2004. Monti, who's currently a senator for life, spoke with Bloomberg's Francine Lacroix.
When you look at the Treaty of Rome, is 2017 the year where actually the EU and the Eurozone could unravel?
There is a risk. Let's face it, there is a risk. So this is an occasion in which the leaders of the member states will have to really get their act together, have a vision for the future, But to me, the fundamental factor which will decide whether the EU will one day unravel or not is whether national politics in member states will continue to drift towards short-termism, nationalism, populism, or whether we will go back to a sense of historical responsibility, because the EU has been an historical construction, has achieved a lot, immensely, for Europe, and it cannot end up as a side victim of irresponsible political behavior in most national countries.
Senator, every time you look at political risk, people worry in the shorter term about France, but actually longer term, they really worry about the viability of Italian public finances. I've also heard things saying that, or people saying that we may need, Italy may need a bailout by the end of the year. What do you answer to those people that think that?
Well, I will answer, have a quick look back. Italy was in a terrible situation in 2011, risk of default, and then it turned out to be the only southern European country to come out of that without a single euro of international support. Last year, there was an amazing concern worldwide for the Italian referendum in December. And the general view was that should Prime Minister Renzi lose that referendum, it would have been financial chaos in Italy and Europe. Nothing of that sort happened. So I believe now it's extremely important, this is really important, that Italy does not go back to the pre-2012 situation, namely to a situation where the EU has to put Italy under the so-called excessive deficit procedure. The Italian government right now is deeply committed to avoiding this. I believe it will. It would have been devastating from this point of view to run early elections this year. And once that is cleared, I mean, once it's clear that Italy does not go back under this special surveillance, I think the attention will leave Italy a bit, and indeed, as you say, turn to France and then, of course, to Germany.
And, Senator, I understand, of course, the Italian constitution does not allow a referendum on Eurozone membership to happen, but what do you think the Italian people would vote nowadays if it would be possible to do a referendum? What are the chances of having an anti-Euro party like Cinque Stelle be in power?
The noise, the general noise perceived in Italy is definitely for leaving the euro. But besides the fact, as you say, that there cannot be a referendum, even if there were one, I believe that as people's minds focused on voting yes or no, then an assault of realism will happen, and I'm pretty sure that Italians will vote to stay in the euro. But as you said, and I, as I stress again, there is not that possibility of a referendum.
That was former Italian Prime Minister Mario Monti speaking with Bloomberg's Francine Lacroix.
And coming up, we'll be speaking with Doug Peterson, CEO of S&P Global.
You can see all the Bloomberg Best Stories at Best Go. This is Bloomberg.
With the Bloomberg Business of Sports Report, I'm Michael Barr. A Las Vegas casino owner is in line to win $1 million if Michigan wins the NCAA men's basketball tournament. Derek Stevens, who owns the D Las Vegas and Golden Gate casinos, bet $12,500 on the Wolverines at the rival Golden Nugget Casino in Las Vegas. The Golden Nugget was offering 80-1 odds before the tournament started. Stevens, a Michigan native and University of Michigan alumnus, bet $11,000 each on all 32 first-round games. He was down $109,000 after the opening round. AB InBev is opening a cold one to celebrate. They got the exclusive rights to sell beer in Russian state stadiums during the 2018 World Cup soccer tournament. AB InBev also got the rights to sell Budweiser at this year's Confederation Cup. Jerry Krause, the former general manager of the Chicago Bulls in the 1990s, has died. Jerry Krause was 77. And that is a Bloomberg Business of Sports report. I'm Michael Barr.
It's 48 minutes past the hour, and now it's time for Bloomberg View.
I'm Megan McArdle, a columnist for Bloomberg View. We spend more on healthcare and have lower life expectancy than any other developed nation. Have you heard that? If you haven't, you probably don't read the news. It's true as far as it goes, but people aren't just sharing a fun fact like Babe Ruth used to cool his head by keeping a cabbage leaf under his hat. They're interested in the implication that by moving to more universal coverage, we could spend less on healthcare and lower our mortality rate. That's pretty dubious. A nation's healthcare system isn't the only thing driving its mortality rate. It's not even necessarily the most important. Don't believe me? 1 year after Obamacare went into effect, age-adjusted mortality rose for the first time in decades. Nor can we necessarily spend less. No country in the world has cut healthcare spending long-term without a major crisis. Our costs aren't growing noticeably faster than the rest of the OECD, so we can't fix the problem by lowering the growth rate to European levels either. There are reasons to support more government involvement in the healthcare sector, but longer lives at lower cost probably isn't among them. I'm Megan McArdle, a columnist for Bloomberg View. For more commentary, go to BloombergView.com or view Go on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Thanks, Megan. And now let's check in with the Bloomberg affiliates to find out what's happening on the nation's most influential radio stations.
I'm Larry Kofsky, and on Bloomberg 99.1 in Washington, I'm reporting on shrinking inventories of homes for sale in D.C.
I'm Courtney Donahoe on KTRH in Houston. The rally in global oil prices has stalled at the worst possible time for explorers, just as banks reassess credit lines.
I'm Gina Cervetti, and for WBBM in Chicago, I'm reporting that billionaire Patrick Soon-Shiong has boosted his stake in the publisher of the Chicago Tribune.
I'm Elisa Parenti on KNX in Los Angeles. I'm reporting on California-based BB closing all of its locations across the country.
I'm Ed Corey on WOAI in San Antonio. I'm reporting oil has dipped back below $50 a barrel.
Thank you, Ed. President Trump recently laid out his plan that would steer as much as $1 trillion in public and private funds to U.S. infrastructure over the coming years. But there's still a lot of questions on how this will work.
Douglas Peterson, the head of S&P Global and the co-chair of the Bipartisan Policy Center's CEO Council on Infrastructure, breaks down what he's looking for over the next few months.
When it comes to the opportunities for infrastructure in the United States, there's a few items we're going to be looking for. In particular, what are the different ways we can see the private sector get more involved in financing infrastructure and the different kind of structures around that? So what we'll be looking for, are there going to be proposals that have the states being able to get more involved directly in infrastructure through the private sector? And at the federal level, will there be programs, A, just to have infrastructure investment overall, some kind of a vision and a prioritization for infrastructure? And B, what will be the ways to get the private sector involved?
Let's talk about those ways. I know that there are some tax credits, tax incentives being floated. How effective do you think that that would be?
Tax incentives could be effective, but there are many different ways to look at infrastructure. Who's going to design it? Who's going to build it? Who's going to finance it? Who's going to operate it? Who's going to maintain it? And you could actually have the private sector involved in any single one of those phases or all of those phases. Question, will the private sector be allowed to have a concession where they actually take something over and run it and operate it, get fees from it to provide the financing? You could do that with ports or with airports. Could you have roads that are being run with tolls? Tolls are different ways to provide financing that come from the operations of those roads that could be used for private sector financing. There's another thing you could look at. There are these different programs that have taken place in the past, TIFIA bonds, Move America bonds, which are being proposed, Build America bonds, ways that you can provide any sort of a tax incentive to the private sector to invest in private sector investment of infrastructure. So there's really many, many different ways you could get the private sector involved.
How important is vision with a plan like this? You've got a government, clearly a president who really wants to champion this. But so much infrastructure seems driven at the local and state level. How do you marry the two things, having a national project to do this and yet getting states and local municipalities involved?
The states and local municipalities are absolutely necessary. You can't have an infrastructure plan without them. But we really have a need right now to have a broader vision. If we want to have an infrastructure boom in the United States, which is so important for many, many reasons, it would be incredibly valuable if there's a vision coming from the top, something that allows states and local governments to have ways to transfer best practices across them, to learn from each other. How could you have the federal government have programs that are consistent and have over time they give the flexibility and the consistency that the private sector knows what they're getting in for? And also some ways that you can have some reality built into the budget, that infrastructure provides so much value, you should have some federal government ownership and oversight of certain types of infrastructure. It creates a foundation that makes it even easier for the states and local governments to have that as part of their foundation as well.
Doug, when you look at the magnitude of our infrastructure problems in the U.S. and you look at the top line figure the president has proposed, is it a big enough number, do you think?
It's the $1 trillion number. It's a great start. If you look at, there's many different estimations. The work that I did with the Bipartisan Policy Center, the number we were using was about $3.3 trillion over the next decade. There's another number that the American civil engineers use. It's about $5 trillion. That's over a longer time period. But what, no matter how we look at it, the numbers are huge. And at numbers that large, whether it's from the trillions to the 5 trillions, you're never going to be able to do it with government funding alone. This is why you need to find solutions and multiple solutions that also include private sector financing as part of it.
Help me understand the economic case for doing this. Of course, if there's a broken bridge, you want to fix it. But there are those who are skeptical that this could have a long-term positive economic effect. What's the economic case for doing this, spending this kind of money?
There's two different cases. The first is that the infrastructure itself creates jobs, it creates growth, and it creates lots of different kinds of jobs. There's designers, all the way from designers and architects to basically high-skilled construction-type jobs and high-skilled worker jobs. So you see the actual job creation from the infrastructure itself. And sometimes people will complain, well, many times those jobs are the bridge to nowhere. And you want to make sure that you avoid the bridge to nowhere type of an infrastructure project that only gets that one-time hit from the infrastructure. What's really valuable is when you're creating necessary infrastructure. You're building bridges that connect communities. You're building tunnels. You're building ports. You're modernizing airports. These types of investments have a multiplier effect. And that multiplier effect, we've estimated at S&P Global that it's about a 1.7 times in the U.S., which means that if you invest $1 billion in infrastructure, you're going to get that $1 billion of investment, and you get about another $1.7 billion of additional investment on top of that. What does that mean? You build an airport, the airport costs $1.7 billion. What else are you going to get around it? You're going to get parking lots, you're going to get rental car agencies, you're going to get fast food, you're going to get gasoline stations, and inside the airport you're going to get shopping, you're going to get food courts. All of that adds up to another 1.7 times, and infrastructure done in the right way for the right reasons really creates jobs and growth, and it's the multiplier effect is way beyond the initial infrastructure.
Doug, quickly here, you've got this global vantage. You're looking at other countries, other places that have tried public-private partnerships like this one. What are the success stories? What should we be looking at as examples?
Some of the best examples are from Canada and Australia, and there's others, especially in Scandinavia and other parts of Europe. The examples you see is where there's an overall system where the capital markets, and by that I mean the long-term capital markets, so pension funds and insurance companies, have been finding ways that they can match the assets to their liabilities, and they can invest in long-term infrastructure programs that are run by governments that have provided ways that the private sector can be involved in concessions, privatizations, or ownership of infrastructure. So places like Canada and Australia and many parts of Europe, the airports, many of the roads, the ports, certain things like tunnels, et cetera, what I call economic infrastructure, has been either owned, operated, or through concessions from the private sector. So there are a lot of models we can look to. And fortunately, you have this match of the long-term financing is being provided to assets which also benefit their communities.
Doug, let me ask just a couple questions about the economy more broadly and your business in it here. I wonder how the Trump administration has changed your business as we look ahead perhaps to a sort of tax repatriation holiday. Could that have an effect on the bond market where companies might be issuing less debt?
We've looked at that very carefully, but let me take a step back and talk about the numbers. There's about $2.5 trillion of cash offshore that's been there because of the traditional tax system that we have in the United States. If there is some kind of a tax repatriation or a territorial system that's put in place, which we believe that tax reform overall would be very valuable, comprehensive tax reform in particular, or maybe also even if it's just corporate tax reform.
That was Douglas Peterson, the CEO of S&P Global, speaking with Bloomberg's David Gura.
That's all for this edition of Bloomberg Best. Our show is produced by David Sucherman and Richard Truman.
I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm June Grosso. This is Bloomberg.